From WBUR Boston and NPR, I'm Meghna Chakrabarty, and this is On Point. What exactly does Vladimir Putin really want? The Russian president has taken a conventionally weak hand and transformed his nation into one of the most disruptive powers on the 21st century global stage. And in her new book, longtime Russia expert Angela Stent puts forth two important ideas. One, that the West played a key role in allowing Russia's ascendance. And two, that the West may also not be prepared to deal with the depths of Putin's convictions and his ambitions for Russia's future. So this hour on Point, from superpower to disruptive power, Vladimir Putin on the world stage. And you can join us. What's your question about Putin and Russia? What do you make of Vladimir Putin's impact on American politics, and how should the U.S. respond? Join us anytime at onpointradio.org or on Twitter and Facebook at onpointradio. And a little later this hour, we will talk about the latest in the Mueller investigation ahead of Michael Cohen's congressional testimony this week. But first, let's spend a considerable amount of time with Angela Stent. She joins us from New York, and she's director of the Center for Eurasian, Russian, and East European Studies and a professor of government and foreign service at Georgetown University. Her new book is Putin's World, Russia Against the West and with the Rest. We have an excerpt of it at onpointradio.org. Angela Stent, welcome back to the program.
Well, thank you. It's good to be on the program.
And forgive me here for being a little choked up. It's not the content of your book necessarily. I've got a seasonal cold here, so forgive me. But first of all, I actually want to start with something that you write about in the opening pages of your book, about a key way to understand Vladimir Putin's motivations. And that is through his passion for the sport of judo. Now, why did you write about that?
Yes. Because people normally say, well, Russians are very good at playing chess. But if you read Putin's autobiography that was published when he first became president, he talks about growing up as a kind of small child who was bullied, didn't do very well in school. And what saved him really was when he started to learn martial arts, judo. And by the time he was 24, he was the judo champion in Leningrad. I have a picture of that in the book. And I guess what he learned from judo is, even if you're smaller and weaker than your opponent, you can take advantage of your opponent's distraction and their own weaknesses if you figure out what they are, and you can still prevail. And I think if you take that plus his training as a KGB case officer, he has been very good at understanding and exploiting the weaknesses of his opponents.
Right. I mean, you even quote him as saying judo was a tool to assert himself. He said, to assert myself in the pack.
In the pack. Oh, yes.
So has this been, I mean, has this really been a driving force for him for most of his life? Because as you say, you can see analogous behavior on how he's exploited weaknesses in the West for the past several years.
Well, I think it has. And I mean, going back to being a KGB case officer, what he writes about that, when he was in East Germany for 5 years, he sort of worked with people. He understood how to get information from them. And then, of course, there was the period when the wall came down, when he was out of a job as a former KGB case officer, when he was driving people around what was then Leningrad became St. Petersburg. And I think he has managed remarkably, really, given where he came from, to work his way up to the top and command the world stage.
Yeah. So I think one thing which you write about so well in the book that the entire West ought to understand more and help us explore it is how Russians see themselves, right, historically. Because you write about how Putin has a strength in appealing to what you call the dual legacies of superiority and inferiority complexes in the Russian psyche. What do you mean?
So, I mean, the Russians believe, and this is something that Putin wants them to believe and talks about it a lot, that they are an exceptional civilization. Now, of course, many countries believe that they're exceptional, including the United States. But if you take the size of the country, its history, they believe that they are a unique civilization, that they're a civilization that doesn't necessarily believe in individualism, but much more collective, and that they are in many ways superior to the West. And today, Putin talks about the fact that Russia is the true inheritor of Christianity as it was, and not the, what he calls a satanic, a decadent Christianity of the West. And so there has always been historically this feeling of superiority, and yet the consciousness that economically and in materially in many ways, they have always lagged behind the West, and the West has looked down on them. And I think you always, you get a sense of grievance that then feeds into an, a sense also of superiority, and that can sometimes be a quite lethal combination.
But yet it's a combination that, that exists and has helped elevate Vladimir Putin to his hold on power in Russia. I mean, you say that what sort of ties these competing forces together is what you call the Russian idea. What is that?
So the Russian idea, again, is this sense of Russia's unique place,
okay,
sort of in the heartland of Europe. It's the largest country in the world and has been so for a long time. And it has these endowments, almost mystical endowments. And even if it's materially behind the West, it is, if you like, spiritually superior to the West. And it will never be part of the West. And I quote some of the 19th and 18th century philosophers there who said, Russia can never work well with the West. We will always be antagonists of the West because we have a different and a better way of life.
Now, and so this is a Russian idea versus a Soviet idea.
This is a Russian idea versus a Soviet idea. And in the Soviet period, that idea was still there, but it was sort of superseded, at least superficially, by the philosophy, the ideology of communism, and that communism, Soviet communism, was superior to capitalism. But in a way, what we know now about the Soviet period is those ideas, the official Marxism-Leninism, really reinforced the traditional Russian idea, which also contains ideas about the importance of a strong leader and the people who, you know, revere the Tsar or the General Secretary, as it was in the Soviet period.
Okay, so the reason why I asked that is because one of the central questions of your book is, you know, following the collapse of the Soviet Union in the 90s, why did the West miss the stew of issues and ideas that led to Vladimir Putin's rise? And is it because we were focused on the ideology of communism versus this Russian idea that was still there?
I think we were. I think the West believed that once communism had collapsed, then Russia would be free to become a democracy like the West. And we looked at what happened in some of the East European countries, Poland, for instance, that did then, after the collapse of communism, move fairly quickly toward what looked then like a democracy. And I think we misunderstood that a lot of what we didn't like about the Soviet Union wasn't really so much the Marxist-Leninist ideology, but what was because of Russian history and the Russians' idea of their place in the world. And it took us, I think, more than a decade to realize that the reason things didn't work out the way we wanted wasn't because the Russians were communists, but actually because they were Russians and they have this very different worldview.
Well, so given that you write in the book how Russia seemingly has in part always defined itself, in part, given its opposition to the West, mm-hmm. was it the arrogance of the West in the 90s that is the reason why we missed this?
Well, I think to some extent, in the beginning, in the middle of the 90s, there were very well-intentioned people in the U.S. administration who talked to Russians who appeared to believe in all of these Western values and the Western way of life. We talked to Russian liberals who told us things that we wanted to hear, and I think to some extent they really believed them. And we just failed to understand the depth of the resentment in post-Soviet Russia about what had happened with the collapse of the Soviet Union. And Putin very much articulates that when he says that the collapse of the Soviet Union was a geopolitical catastrophe of the 20th century. I think we failed to understand that. And then I think we didn't realize what it was like for the Russian people, the impoverishment of the 1990s and the way they saw a small group of people become incredibly rich. And many of these people were then to their mind, backed by the United States. And I think we missed all of that. And then suddenly when Putin came back, we began to realize that he was just trying to restore what he believed Russia should rightfully be and get rid of what happened in the 1990s.
Right. So you mentioned how Putin calls the collapse of the Soviet Union a catastrophe. We actually have a clip from Vladimir Putin's 2005 State of the Union address, I guess it's the way to call it, State of the Nation address that he gave in Moscow. And he told Russia's top political leaders, yes, that indeed the collapse of the Soviet Union was a catastrophe. And here Putin's saying, first of all, we have to admit that the crash of the Soviet Union was the greatest geopolitical catastrophe of the century, and it became a real drama for the Russian people. Tens of millions of our compatriots found themselves outside the Russian territory. That's Vladimir Putin in 2005. Angela Stent, reflect with us on that last sentence there. Tens of millions of our compatriots found themselves outside the Russian territory. How significant is that?
Oh, I think it is. I mean, you had at the collapse of the Soviet Union, 22 million Russian-speaking people. They may have been only partly ethnically Russian, but who were not living in the Russian Federation. They were in Ukraine. They were in Kazakhstan. They were in all of the post-Soviet states, including, of course, the Baltic republics at that point, too. And so for Putin, the idea that this had been one country and that suddenly it was rent asunder and you had all these Russians living outside of Russia, sort of homeless in a way. And this is why, of course, most Russians, I would say, after the collapse of the Soviet Union, do not regard Ukraine, for instance, as a separate country. They think there was so much intermarriage between, say, Russians and Ukrainians, and they believe that they're really all part of one family. And, of course, that's what Putin's been trying to appeal to.
Mm. Well, we're talking this hour with Angela Stent. She's director of the Center for Eurasian, Russian, and East European Studies and a professor of government and foreign service at Georgetown University. Her new book is Putin's World, Russia Against the West and with the Rest. We have an excerpt of it at onpointradio.org. This is On Point. We'll be right back.
Support for the On Point podcast comes from Indeed. If you need to hire, you need Indeed. Indeed is your matching and hiring platform that lets you find candidates fast. Ditch the busy work and use Indeed for scheduling, screening, and messaging so you can connect with candidates faster. And listeners get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/onpoint. That's Indeed.com/onpoint. Terms and conditions apply. Need to hire? You need Indeed.
This is On Point. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. We're talking this hour with Angela Stent. Her new book is Putin's World, Russia Against the West and with the Rest. And we're talking about how Vladimir Putin has fashioned Russia into perhaps the most disruptive power of the 21st century, as opposed to a superpower. And Professor Stent, I mean, of course, in a few moments, we'll talk about Russia's efforts and Putin's efforts at disrupting democratic processes here. But you write very interestingly about how Russia's sort of posture in the world and a gauge of its influence can be seen in the Middle East. So can you talk about that? I mean, how has Russia become a new power broker in the Middle East?
I mean, it's really quite amazing. And I think the reason partly is because, again, Putin has sensed an opening, a vacuum, which he moved in and very cleverly, if you like, exploited. Russia always supported the Assad family. The Soviet Union in Syria had close ties, and the Russians were supporting Bashar Assad in the civil war, but not materially very much. And then it appeared as if Assad was going to get defeated in 2015. And remember, before that, President Obama had said there would be a red line in Syria if the Syrian government used chemical weapons against its own people. It did so. And then in the end, there wasn't a red line because the U.S. and its allies did not move in more robustly there. And so that's when Putin sent his planes out. They began a bombing campaign in Syria, and they've really ensured that President and Assad will survive. But it goes beyond Syria, too. Russia, unlike in the Soviet times, pursues a very pragmatic policy in the Middle East. I spoke to a senior Israeli diplomat who said to me that Russian policy in the Middle East, and I think it captures it well, it's aggressive. And it's flexible, but it's cognizant of its own limits. And so unlike the Soviet times, Russia talks to all parties on all sides of the conflict. It talks to the Shia states, the Sunni states, and to Israel. I think two of the more remarkable developments in the past couple of years have been the rapprochement with Saudi Arabia on the one hand, which the Soviet Union never had diplomatic relations with during the Cold War period, and with Israel, which was again a very fraught relationship for a very long time.
Right.
Why? Because both of these countries believe that Russia can use its influence on Iran to temper Iranian ambitions. I think they're probably wrong, but they all look to Russia as the one country that can do that.
So this is particularly fascinating to me because you write about how Russia is styling itself or behaving as the power that will be the defender of the status quo in the region, right? Versus the United States, which would be seen or is seen as a disruptor, a regime change advocate in the region.
Right. So for Putin, and I've been in a small gathering with him where he's talked about it, the absolute worst thing was the Arab Spring and what happened to Muammar Gaddafi. And you may recall at that point, the West was able to help the Libyans prevail over him because of a UN resolution on which Russia abstained. Anyway, he looks at what happened to Gaddafi being dragged through a sewer and being killed as the worst kind of regime change. And so Russia puts itself forward as a supporter of all governments, however they were elected, but they're legitimately in power according to Russia, and it will support them. And it portrays the United States as the disruptor and the proponent of regime change, of course, going back to the Iraq War.
But in the case of this rapprochement, as you said, between Moscow and Saudi Arabia and Israel, you're also talking about two nations which are ostensibly very close allies to the United States.
Exactly. And I think that's another remarkable thing that we have seen happen. And I think, you know, there are different reasons. I mean, in the Israeli case, some of it has to do with Iran and the war in Syria. A lot of it has to do with it. But it also has to do with the fact you have 1.3 million Israelis who come from the former Soviet Union and their real bonds there. And in the Saudi case, it's oil and oil prices and energy that have driven Russia and Saudi Arabia much closer together because they now have an agreement. Russia's cooperating with OPEC to try and keep production down so that the price of oil can be high.
So given that, how is it that the United States and its posture towards the Middle East, you're not saying that Russia would fully replace the U.S. in terms of influence in the region, are you?
No, Russia can't replace the United States in the Middle East. It doesn't have the resources, it doesn't have the military or the economic resources. But what it can do is, A, act as a disruptor in terms of what U.S. goals might be, you know, particularly, let's say, vis-a-vis Iran, whom Russia supports. And again, as a country that, you know, which all sides will talk to in a way, and the United States doesn't have those links. We don't talk to Hamas or Hezbollah, and we don't talk to Iran, obviously. So Russia has some cards there that the U.S. doesn't have.
Now, you just said that Russia supports Iran because we've seen that they're party to the Iran nuclear agreement, or is this?
Well, they're party to the, and you know, they've had close ties to Iran. They've built nuclear power plants there. You know, they support them in the UN. The relationship has its own tensions. But, you know, Russia certainly is a big supporter, as are our European allies, of the continuation of the Iran nuclear deal, for instance. But, you know, there are business ties and other links there.
Okay. So is this another situation, though, in which the West, and here particularly the United States, has created the space, created the vacuum in which Russia is stepping in and being the pragmatic power or a pragmatic power in the region? Because as the United States...
Yeah.
No, go ahead.
No, I was just going to say, I mean, definitely. And I think that, again, that began in the Obama administration. It has to do with the fact that, you know, many Americans are tired of the United States being involved militarily overseas, and particularly in the Middle East, where everything seems so intractable. So you had, again, under President Obama, indecision about what the U.S. should do, and beginning the withdrawal from Syria. And of course, now you have President Trump saying that basically we're getting out of Syria, except leaving a few hundred troops there for the time being. So, yes, this is something but where Putin, again, has sensed Western weakness and indecision and has just moved in.
Well, let's go to the calls if we can. We're speaking with Angela Stent. Her new book is Putin's World, Russia Against the West and with the Rest. And let's go to Tim, who's calling from Fort Benning, Georgia. Tim, you're on the air.
Yes. Hello, ma'am. Thank you for taking my call. My question is, you know, what is the best action the U.S., NATO, and the West can do in relation to President Putin and what his short-term and long-term goals are? So, really, you know, what can we do to counter his desires?
Well, Tim, thank you for your call. Angela Stent, go ahead.
Thank you. I mean, it's a great question. So the first thing that we could do is we should have a more united West. And unfortunately, the West is more disunited than at any time, you know, since the end of World War II, with a combination of what the Trump administration is doing with our allies in Europe, and then Europe's own problems, the Brits leaving the European Union, and all the political polarization that exists there. So it would help if we were more united, and we could sort of stand up to Russia that way. And so, you know, what else can we do? I think we have to have our own defenses domestically against all of the kinds of election interference that we see from Russia, both on the social media. We have a long way to go there. Even, you know, in the cyber area too, we have to have better defenses. But there's certain things that we're not going to do, right? We didn't intervene militarily to counter Russia in Ukraine because we understood nobody wants to do that this is more important to Russia than it is to us. So then we have to think about the consequences of that if we're not going to do that. How do we then deal with, say, the Ukrainian conflict? And I don't think anyone else has come up with a suggestion yet. But I do also think that we need to engage Russia on some issues. I think it's unfortunate that, for instance, we're pulling out of the INF agreement, even though it's the Russians who've been cheating on it, and yet they would like to stay in it. And I think on the arms control area, we do have to think about dealing with Russia because it is the other major nuclear superpower.
Right, and the INF agreement being the Intermediate
Nuclear
Forces.
Nuclear Forces Treaty.
Yeah. I mean, in fact, just recently, Putin was saying, look, I mean, if you want to have another Cuban Missile Crisis-style crisis, then Russia, he claims Russia is ready. He was talking about ship-based nuclear missiles that can reach Mach 9.
Right. He gave a very belligerent, he gave a State of the Nation speech a couple of days ago. Most of it had to do with the economy. But when he started to talk about the weapons in the United States, it was really pretty belligerent, saying that if you start deploying these intermediate range missiles in Europe again, we will not only counter you, but we'll go beyond that.
Right. Well, so to your point about that Putin was speaking about the State of the Nation internally in Russia here, I mean, we should talk about that a little because we're talking about his international power projection, the international disruption that Russia has brought to the world stage. But internally in Russia, we still have, 19 million Russians living in poverty out of a nation of 145 million people. Putin is promising all sorts of new social programs. We have a comment here from someone calling themselves Salvation, who says, can we even still call Russia a superpower? This is a country where schools don't have running water, where the population and economy are collapsing.
Well, so historically, this goes back also to the Russian idea. I mean, the one area in which Russia has always been able to project power is through its military, right? So even though its military is much smaller and weaker than that of the United States, it can still project enough power so that it can disrupt in Ukraine, in the Middle East, or wherever else. But yes, the economic fundamentals are really quite bad, and Putin spoke about that a couple of days ago. The population is declining, and it's unclear whether that can be reversed. It has crumbling infrastructure. culture. As you said, as the caller said, you know, there are many rural areas where there's great poverty and there's no running water. And yet there are cities like Moscow that are kind of gleaming where people live pretty well. The rate of growth is about 1.5% per annum. The Western sanctions have affected the Russian economy adversely, even though they haven't changed Russian behavior. So, yes, this is not a power that's on the rise. It's declining economically. It's declining demographically. And yet it still does have the ability to project power in this disruptive way.
Well, let's go to Dolores, who's calling from Waterford, Pennsylvania. Dolores, you're on the air.
Yes. Hi, I have a couple of questions. Number one, at one point, the Western Europeans referred to the Russian Empire as the sick man of Europe. And I wonder how that would play today in the minds of the Russians and themselves, as far as it's almost as though, to a degree, there's an inferiority complex, although they think they're above everybody else. Number two, the United States beefed up that buffoon, that drunken buffoon, Yeltsin. And I'm wondering how things would have been different if Mikhail Gorbachev would have remained in power, and what happens to Russia after Putin?
Dolores, thank you for your call. Go ahead, Angela.
Those are a lot of questions. Yeah. I think the Europeans actually refer to Turkey as the sick man of Europe, but I guess they could have also referred to Russia that way. Well, I think that this sense, the Russians feel in many ways what Putin has done is to appeal to their patriotism and to make them and sort of feelings of superiority. But they understand that economically they're behind the West. But Putin has increasingly been blaming the West for Russia's economic difficulties. And of course, it's easy to do that when we just keep slapping more and more sanctions on Russia. But, I think Russians still have that kind of mixture of superiority and inferiority. When you look back on the Gorbachev era now, it really does seem the golden age in many ways of, you know, the late Soviet period. There probably was more freedom of expression. There was more equality under Gorbachev, certainly. And of course, the relationship with the West kept improving, even though Gorbachev, of course, is tremendously unpopular in Russia. I think from our vantage point, it really does look like a golden age. I remember during the Yeltsin period, you know, our officials would come back and they'd scratch their heads and say, yes, it's difficult dealing with him, but there is no alternative to him. So by the time that he came in and then you had the enrichment of a small number of Russians, and then you had the chaos, economic chaos for many other Russians, he was really the only person that the West felt that they could deal with. At that point, there wasn't another alternative. If Gorbachev had remained in power, then, of course, you still would have had the Soviet Union. So then the question is, could he have created a Soviet Union where the different constituent republics had a more equal relationship with Moscow? And of course, in trying to do that, that's really why he was overthrown. So we can look back on that period now and say, you know, maybe it really was a golden age, but I'm not sure how it could have continued.
Hmm. Well, let's go to Anne, who's calling from Boston, Massachusetts. Anne, you're on the air.
Hi, or should I say dobry den? I lived in the former Soviet Union from 1999 to 2001, and I grew up not knowing the difference between Russia and the Soviet Union. I learned very quickly, and that has since been reinforced. I teach English to adults, and I've had many ethnic Russians and people from Ukraine and all over. And the students, when they're in, there is a superiority. They're highly educated. There's a lot of reasons for it, but they're very proud, and there is a superiority and a seriousness that we in the West don't understand. And sometimes I wonder, you know, they've been around. It's just kind of an interesting perspective because that country's existed before much longer than the United States. And I sometimes think of the United States as a overprivileged teenager that's just running around telling everybody else what to do. And I think that's how we're viewed as a country. Like, we're not old enough. I lived in a town that was 400 years old, which is longer than the United States even existed.
Well, Anne, actually, can I just, we've just got a minute to go before I take a quick break. So let me turn your points to Angela Stent. What do you think, Angela?
No, I think those are all very interesting points. And I think the caller makes an important point, which is I think often the United States does not give Russia and Russians enough respect. I mean, whether it's some of the things that President Obama said when he called Russia a regional power or said that Putin reminded him of a bored schoolboy slouching in the back of a classroom. And I think this, you know, you can go back to the 1990s. I think maybe we did sort of have an arrogant attitude. And yes, many Russians, as they rightly should be, are proud of their country and believe that they should get more respect.
Well, Angela Stent's new book is Putin's World, Russia Against the West and with the Rest. We'll talk more about it when we come back. What's your question for Angela Stent? And what do you think the West and the United States ought to do to deal with what Stent calls Russia's new power as a disruptive force on the global stage? This is On Point.
Did you kill Marlene Johnson?
I think you're one of the first people to have actually asked.
From WBUR and ZSP Media, this is Beyond All Repair, a new podcast about an unsolved murder that will leave you questioning everything.
Somebody should be in jail for murdering my sister.
A woman who's never been believed.
As long as they think I have done this, then they're not looking for who actually did this.
And that's what makes it a cold case.
No, it's a botched case.
And a search for the truth, once and for all.
Wow, it just gets more interesting.
Beyond All Repair. Listen and follow wherever you get your podcasts.
Be careful. You're digging in a place that's been very peaceful for a while.
Do it anyway. Dig.
This is On Point. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. We're talking with Angela Stent this hour. She's director of the Center for Eurasian, Russian, and East European Studies, a professor of government and foreign service at Georgetown University. And she's written this really fascinating new book called Putin's World, Russia Against the West and with the Rest. And Professor Stent, I want to play another moment from a speech that Vladimir Putin gave. This is from the 2007 Security Conference in Munich, Germany, where Putin lashed out at the United States in front of a whole cohort of Western leaders, blaming the U.S. for wrecking global stability. You're going to hear this excerpt of Putin's speech with an English voiceover from the PBS Frontline documentary Putin's Revenge.
The United States has overstepped its national borders in the economic, political, and humanitarian spheres it imposes on other nations. Well, who would like this?
Angela Stent, that was from 2007, and you say it's an important it's an important moment to recognize, to understand Putin. And why is that?
Yeah, that was really a turning point. That was when he finally, all of his frustrations came out. And it's a combination of, I think, he expected something different from supporting the United States after 9/11 and during, particularly during the fall of 2001, during the Afghanistan war. He really expected the United States to recognize that Russia did have a sphere of influence in the post-Soviet space and really to treat Russia as an equal. He wanted, as one of my Russian colleagues said, an equal partnership of unequals. And what did he get? The United States, you know, withdrew from the anti-ballistic missile treaty in December of 2001. Then, of course, we had the Iraq war where we didn't even consult the Russians before we went in. And then we had, you know, the color revolutions in Georgia and Ukraine and just the frustration was building up. And finally, Putin made his visit to Munich and made this very belligerent speech and declared really that kind of the era of trying to work with the United States in a productive way was over.
Hmm. So, Angela Stent, if I may, over the course of this conversation, what I hear is you describing a cascade of failures in terms of the West and its view, understanding, and approach to Russia. I mean, I'm even thinking about moments such as when President George W. Bush, what was it, in 2001, said that he looked into Vladimir Putin's eyes and saw his soul. So it seems as if part of the problem here that you're describing is the West's ignorance of Russia, what drives Russian history, a spectacular naivete, inaction, indecision. I mean, it's a cascade of failures here we're talking about.
Well, I mean, we've certainly made mistakes. I wouldn't blame the West for all of this. I think there's a fundamental incompatibility between what Russia under Putin has sought, which again is a recognition of the post-Soviet space as its sphere of influence and an acceptance by the United States and its allies that they wouldn't try and bring countries like Ukraine or Georgia into the West. That's really what he has wanted. And then also a recognition of Russia as a great power whose interests are as legitimate as those of the United States, even if they're different from those of the United States. And we have understandably not been willing to concede those issues at the moment. I mean, that might change one day. So I think, yes, we've made mistakes, but we've also been faced with a Russia that really hasn't been willing to accept what we believed, you know, was the post-Cold War international order, and now Russia wants to change it. I think you can fault the West for not, or the United States for not having as clear a strategy towards Russia, not knowing what it wanted from Russia, whereas Putin seems to have developed a pretty clear strategy of what he wanted from the world, and he has been pursuing it.
Okay, so if part of Vladimir Putin's endgame here, what I hear you saying is a desire for a certain amount of respect on the global stage, has he forfeited the opportunity for that completely by meddling in, you know, United States democracy? I mean, why now in 2019 would the U.S. change its posture towards Putin? Or
well, it wouldn't, but but the title of my book is Russia Against the West and with the Rest.
Right.
And we mustn't forget that the rest of the world doesn't have the same view of Russia. The Chinese don't. The Indians don't. Many countries in the Middle East don't. In other words, there are many countries around the world that regard Russia as a large authoritarian country with legitimate interests and with whom they're happy to do business. So it's the West, of course, that doesn't want to accept that. And yes, by interfering in the elections in the U.S. and in Europe, Russia has probably forfeited that. And therefore, we're really at a stalemate, and it's very hard to see how we get out of it.
Okay, so let's explore that for another minute, because it's vitally important. You're right. The rest, and it's not just the rest as in some small nations. China and India you're talking about here.
No.
So in a sense, other than, I don't want to downplay, obviously, the very powerful and deep and important tensions between the West and Russia right now. But on the other hand, do those tensions, do they really matter if the other nations that Russia is becoming closer with are so central to global development in the present and future?
Well, they matter in as much as obviously we have experienced Russia's attempts to disrupt our own domestic society and benefit from the polarization that exists here. So that is an issue for us, and it's an issue for our allies. And I would say the other thing is that, you know, that Russia and the United States are the two worlds nuclear superpowers, and these tensions do matter because, you know, we have to regulate that relationship. We have to try and regulate, the nuclear arms issues. Therefore, we cannot just say, well, you know, it's too bad if our relations aren't bad, let them just pursue their partnership with China. So there are real security issues here, too.
Okay, so then because of those vitally important issues, isolation isn't going to work. Refusing to deal with Russia isn't going to work. So what path ought the U.S. follow?
Well, it's a tough one. Again, we have to bolster our own domestic defenses. We have to try and deal with our own domestic polarization. And that's very easy to say. We know it's very difficult to do. And then we have to pursue engagement with Russia on issues that are of vital importance to us and to the Russians, and where, however difficult it is, you know, we can hopefully make progress on some of these issues. Because we cannot isolate Russia. And then I think the other thing is you have to have strategic patience. It's easy to say that, but these things take a very long time to evolve. And I think we mustn't forget that the Russian people out there are not the Russian government. And we have to try and maintain our links to them, exchanges, things like that, because Vladimir Putin will not be in power forever. And at some point, there may be a different Russia.
Yeah, let's take another call. Let's go to Mike, who's calling from Natick, Massachusetts. Mike, you're on the air.
Hi, thanks. Look, at this point, there's no dealing with this guy, Putin, that is, as far as economically or any other way, no olive branch. What he's done is irreversible to a certain degree. The way to handle this guy is simple. We have something he'll never have. We've got countries that abut his country. We've got allies. We've got friendly countries that we do business with. We should load those countries up with weapons, missiles, so on and so on. He can't do that, and he can't do anything about it. And then we should sanction the heck out of him even more, because this guy is, there's no dealing with him. He's not an honorable person. He's like our president. Hey, he's not an honorable.
Mike, can I just jump in here for a second? So if you're suggesting putting weapons in Eastern European countries, that's exactly the thing that Vladimir Putin said. If that happens, he's going to put Russian ships with nuclear weapons on it in international waters and have missiles that could reach the United States. I mean, like, that's exactly the kind of ratcheting up of tension that he said could happen. So is that a viable option for you?
Well, you tell me, what else are we going to do to control this guy? I mean, the current president we have now is in bed with him. So how else can we handle this guy? We need to isolate him. And the way to isolate him is use the only advantage we have. The countries that abut him, we're friendly with for the most part, and we can help them out militarily and financially. He doesn't have that with us.
Right.
He can put his ships. See, ship warfare is a thing of the past. A ship is a sitting duck. It's old mentality.
Oh, I see. Okay, Mike, we're going to run out of time here with Angela Stent, so I want to take your thoughts and turn them back to her. Angela, much harder line being advocated there by Mike.
Well, I mean, we already have beefed up our troop presence in Central Europe, particularly in Poland, and our allies have beefed up their troop presence in the Baltic states. But these countries are right next to Russia, and, you know, the calculation always there is you don't want to do something that will provoke an even stronger reaction from Russia. And this, again, has been why there's never been any military reaction on the part of the West to what's happened in Ukraine, except for supplying the Ukrainians with some lethal defensive weapons. So I think, and ratcheting up sanctions it does have an impact on the Russian economy, but it hasn't appeared so far to change anything that Russia has done. And some of those sanctions are, in fact, hurting our own allies. So I think you need to measure what you're doing, and you have to think through the consequences of possible actions and Russian reactions to that at a time with such tense relations.
Well, Angela Stent is director of the Center for Eurasian, Russian, and East European Studies and a professor of government and foreign service at Georgetown University. Her new book is Putin's World, Russia Against the West and With the Rest. We have an excerpt of it at onpointradio.org. Professor Stent, it's been a great pleasure to have you. Thank you so much for this fascinating new book.
Great. Very good discussion.
All right, folks. So we want to spend the last few minutes of the program giving you an update on, yes, what is essentially another Russia-related story, and that is the fact that Special Counsel Robert Mueller's investigation into Russian election interference might be wrapping up in the coming days. Mueller has now submitted an over 800-page sentencing memo for former Trump campaign manager Paul Manafort, asserting that Manafort, quote, brazenly broke the law. And this week, former Trump private attorney Michael Cohen is set to testify on Capitol Hill. So joining us to discuss the latest details in the investigation is Josh Gerstein, senior legal affairs contributor to Politico. Josh, it's great to have you back with us.
Hey, Meghna, good to be with you again.
All right. So first of all, let's start off with Michael Cohen. On Tuesday and Thursday, he'll be testifying before the House and Senate Intelligence Committees behind closed doors there. And then in between there on Wednesday, he's going to be testifying publicly before the House Oversight Committee. So what is he expected to be asked and what might Cohen say?
Well, that Wednesday event is going to be a big deal. I mean, you're talking about nationally televised testimony and the president's former attorney basically confronting him live and live in color. We expect most of the questions are going to have to do with issues that are not directly on the Russia matter. It still seems like there's some restriction around those kinds of questions being asked publicly. Those ones will probably be asked at those two Intelligence Committee sessions behind closed doors. So I think here you're going to hear primarily about other allegations about the president that have come out in recent months, including the crimes that Michael Cohen pled guilty to, the campaign finance law violations, where he basically admitted that he arranged illegal campaign donations towards the end of the 2016 campaign that were aimed at covering up sexual liaisons that the president had had with women who were threatening to go public with their stories at that time. So you'll hear that. And I think other stories of alleged financial chicanery on the part of the Trump organization. I think those will be the primary focus of Wednesday's hearing.
All right. So that's all going to happen against the backdrop of other things going on this week, including Paul Manafort's sentencing memo that was submitted by the special counsel's office. So it was made public on Saturday. So what are some of the most important things in it, and what impact could it have, or what could it mean for Manafort when he's sentenced in March?
Right. So Manafort's facing a kind of complicated sentencing situation. He was convicted in two different cases. Both were brought by Mueller. One was a jury trial that led to him being convicted, and the other was him pleading guilty after that first trial didn't go well. So in a very unusual situation, he's about to be sentenced by two separate federal judges. And one of the key questions is going to be the judge who goes second here, whether she decides to basically tack her sentence on to the end of whatever he gets in the original case. The original case had to do with tax and bank fraud primarily, and the second case had to do with illegal lobbying, lobbying that was done sort of sub rosa without it being reported to the federal government in violation of federal law, which requires you to report when you're lobbying for foreign governments. And Manafort was working very closely with the president of Ukraine on a multimillion-dollar lobbying effort that was not promptly reported to the Justice Department. So, Mueller really used this memo to lay out a lot of the case he would have made against Manafort in D.C. if that matter ever went to trial. That's where the hundreds and hundreds of pages come to, and it outlines that kind of illegal lobbying scheme. It really didn't give us a great deal of insight, though, on this core question of Russian influence over the Trump campaign. That was kind of left aside and still an open question, right, about how and when we're going to learn what Mueller has discovered on that front.
Well, on that point, though, Josh, just to underscore, I mean, this is exactly the point that the president himself and his supporters would make, that none of this thus far has to do with Russian influence or interference in the election, let alone any collusion. So that leaves the Mueller report as the outstanding sort of blank spot here in our understanding of what happened. So what are you hearing about when that report may be submitted?
So there are a lot of signs that Mueller's operation is beginning to wind down. The very fact that Michael Cohen is being permitted to testify on Capitol Hill suggests that we're moving into a mode where Mueller's not terribly nervous about facts he's gathering being laid out. There are also other indications that some of these cases Mueller has been bringing in the last couple months are in the process of being handed off to permanent federal prosecutors here in Washington, D.C. So we are expecting some kind of a report. I can't tell you whether it would happen. It's apparently not supposed to happen this week. It might happen in the next coming few weeks is what most of us are thinking. But again, as I said earlier, there are real questions about how and when that gets out to the public, how detailed the report is. Does the new Attorney General, Bill Barr, decide to make it public in its entirety, to summarize it, to really strip it down? Or does he wait for a subpoena from maybe the House Judiciary Committee before he turns over detailed information about the probe? I do think that information will come out eventually, yeah. But how and when and how detailed, these are all things that we're waiting to learn in the coming days.
Well, Josh Gerstein, Senior Legal Affairs Contributor to Politico. Josh, always great to have you. Thank you so much.
Thanks, Meghna. Happy to do it.
I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. This is On Point.